This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB FM. My next guest is Joseph Zicardi, and Joseph is the author of three books of poetry: Vents, which was published in 2005 by Pancake Press; Render, published in 2009 by Poetry Matrix Press; and his most recent collection is The Nine Gradations of Light, which was published in 2013 by Bark For Me Publications. I love that name. My dogs would like it too.
Isn't that wonderful?
It is. So Joe is also a Marin County Poet Laureate Emeritus now, because he served for the years 2013 and 2014. And I'm going to talk with him about his Poet Laureate project a little later in the show. But first, I want to concentrate on you, Joe, as a poet. So first of all, welcome to
the
show.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
Thanks for coming up. So I have your first two books of poetry, and I had a really nice time rereading them in preparation for this show. They reminded me a little bit of who you are and where you've been, and it's just great to have them. So the first thing I wanted to ask you is, it appears you were in the Navy during Vietnam. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's right. Correct.
What ship were you on?
I was on the USS Mars, which sounds like it's a fighting ship, but it was a supply ship.
USS Mars.
Yes, we were called the Martians.
That's a wonderful name.
It's actually named after Mars, Pennsylvania, where the keel was laid, where the ship was built.
Oh, very interesting.
And Mars candy bars there. Isn't that lovely?
Great place. It is lovely. If I was going to be on a ship, I'd want to be on the USS Mars for sure. So what did you do when you were in the Navy?
Basically, I ran the barbershop was one thing.
Cool.
That was one of my jobs. But the other thing is I was on the flight deck. We did what they called vertical replenishment, which was called vert rep for the ships in Vietnam and the Gulf of Tonkin, in the Gulf of Tonkin. And I was very lucky in that they chose me to, all I had to do was stand there with a clipboard, and when the forklifts would come and put all these pallets together with all the supplies on them, I would weigh them, or I would record the weighing, I should say, and then I would relay that, the total, like three pallets, say, to the pilot of the helicopter.
Uh-huh.
And it was really important that he knew how much lift.
Exactly, how much weight was coming up
at him. That was my job. It was kind of exciting, though, to watch. And we had ships on both sides of us, plus maybe two other ships behind, back of us, and the helicopters would be going and replenishing all these ships.
Wow.
Out in the Gulf of
Tonkin.
You're
out in the ocean doing this.
There's
a lot of
movement
with these big ships all around.
Yeah, it's really, really exciting.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
Well, I knew someone who was on the USS Enterprise during the Vietnam War, and I went out on a family day excursion and was on the deck when the planes were coming down and landing and taking off. Just
wonderful.
Amazing.
Yeah, we replenished the Enterprise, actually.
I bet you did. Yeah.
And we were 2 days out of Sasebo, Japan, when we finished replenishing, our top speed is 33 knots. The speed of the Enterprise was secret, top secret.
Oh, because it was a nuclear powered warship.
Yeah, but when we got there, the people who lived in Sasebo said, it's been here a day already. So that means it does about 60 knots.
Yeah, wow. So I would like to get right to a couple of poems that resonate this, and one is called Search and Rescue, which is in your first book. That's where we're going to start out today, your first book, Vents. Search and Rescue, which is on page 25, and then a sadder poem to me called Calling Alabama. Hmm. If you would read those two, that would be great.
Absolutely. I'd like to say a little thing about Search and Rescue. It was in Poets Against War.
Oh, good.
And it's probably the most quoted poem. It's interesting.
Was that anthology edited by Sam Hamill?
That's right.
Yeah, I remember that one. Good. Okay.
And, Search and Rescue. In my journal, I write Rescue. Today, we set out to rescue men from an LST run aground in the waters off the Mekong. We are not a part of this country. The first thing I notice is the whistle of bullets through leaves, like birds tearing bits apart. What are the names of these trees? The body we find is stripped of flesh, eyelids peeled away. The body is blue and bloated. it stares at us. There are no birds in the trees, only rain. We taste the metal of rain, look into that face, indecent, red curl around glutinous eyes. We force ourselves to look at the hairless, engorged genitals. Is he one of ours or one of theirs? Everything about the rescue is disproportionate. Everything about the rise and cry above pornographic, the choking roar, the cover of tracer and fire. White blooms at the cross of two rivers. Helicopters evac us to our ship. Breath smoking in the reefers, we store and tag the body. The sun is brown over the hot jungle. I vomit into the cold shaft of the pallet lift. Everything until now is a lie.
Oh, before you move on to the next poem, I asked you to read. This was a personal experience.
Yes, so. My father told me before I went in the Navy, he said, do not volunteer for anything.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally I did.
Yeah, you should have told me to volunteer for everything.
They said we were doing a search and rescue thing, and anyone who wanted to volunteer would get a case of beer and a three-day liberty pass when we got to back to Yokosuka, Japan. So that's what happened. I volunteered. But I thought it was just literally to rescue people. I thought it meant live people.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was bodies. You know.
Ugh. Okay, let's move on to Calling Alabama. That's on page 29.
Thank you. Calling Alabama. It's midnight here on the West Coast. 10 more days to go before 1999 starts to sound old-fashioned. I pace the living room, looking up and down the walls. I caress my hornbill from the Ivory Coast. Phone an old friend from boot camp. It's later there, but he doesn't mind. In fact, sounds relieved, like he's put off something dangerous. We start talking about our youth, when over the hill meant AWOL, laughing about the good times we had, when getting drunk and sick was fun. Before you know it, we're blubbering. Two grown men bawling our eyes out. Over the first time I had grits. I'm a Yankee and don't know grits from farina. And he's losing it. I'm losing it. And New Year's Eve is looming like that black wall in D.C., all those names staring back, lost in the ground. It's getting darker here and lighter in Alabama. Good talking to you, good buddy, we both say. Hang up. I get a tall glass of milk and some oatmeal cookies and look at the largest full moon in 134 years. First night of winter. And he's probably watching the first rays of the new sun, holding his purple heart next to his heart, smiling just a little, saying, it'll be all right. Yeah, all right. It's what men do for other men at some terrible hour. I see something moving in the brush on the downside of my yard. It lets out a horrible scream, one that freezes me under the white circle of light over the kitchen table. Ron didn't put the .45 back in the writing desk drawer. It would be 3 months before I found out. I think when he put the muzzle in his mouth, a train whispered through the Appalachian Valley, then wailed long and hard as if to say, look, my spiral of white smoke will join the purple.
Thank you so much for reading that. That is a tremendous poem, and I think it encapsulates war.
Yes.
Beautifully. Yes. During the Vietnam War, there wasn't a lot of talk about post-traumatic stress disorder for veterans of that war, like there is now, and there really needs to be now. And yet there it was in all its glory. I mean, you hearing a rustling sound in the bushes outside, that's not, you know, you would react in a totally different way than I would react. And this poor man... Alabama.
Yeah,
right?
And the memories come back. And we served in boot camp, and then we also served in the USS Mars together.
Oh,
so we were really good friends, And he was he was a wonderful Southerner, but I used to say, "Could you talk a little faster, please?" and I talk slow. I mean, I think I do. But oh my God, he would get to the end of a sentence, and I would go, "Where did it start? I forgot.
I don't remember what you were talking about."
But he was a great guy, and it really is sad. And I haven't had much myself of this flashbacks, mm-hmm. but every once in a while something will happen. Like I'll be walking my dog, and all of a sudden I'll get a shiver, and I'll see a certain tree move a certain way, you know, and it's just fascinating, you know.
Right, and you don't even know why you're responding like that at the time, right?
Yeah, and I remember when we were collecting the bodies that we were so-called search and rescuing for, I was dispassionate in a way. I was just like, this is a job that needs to be done, mm-hmm. and I needed to take these parts and move them.
These parts, interesting.
Yeah. And they had to be great because, you know, they're going to a family and you want to do a really good job and make sure
Absolutely.
That they get the whole person back.
It's called survival, I think.
Yeah,
you know, you have to do something like that to get through it. And then when you come back home, you have to deal with it.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you for those poems. Really, really
Certainly.
Powerful. So I remember that you read from this book, Vince, for the Word Temple Poetry Series way back in 2008, which really seems like a very long time ago now. And we learn so much. And when did you write most of the poems in this book?
Well, these were pretty old because I started them while I was in the service.
I wondered. Yeah.
So, yeah, Good. Some of them are about maybe 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the other poems run at least about a 20-year period, yeah.
It's good that you hung on to them and did something with them, you know, that they are in your first book of poems.
Yeah,
they had
a typewriter on the ship in the library, and I was a hunting peck.
One finger at a time, yeah.
And that wonderful onion skin paper. That we used to,
yes. Always,
I still have those.
The airmail paper, we used to call it, too.
Just wonderful stuff.
Beautiful stuff. Well, there are many poems in the book that aren't about being in the war, but I'm assuming that it was the war that really pushed you into pulling your first collection together.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Good. There are four sections in the book. They're called Enlisting, Loving, Traveling, and Returning. And the poems travel all over the place, externally and internally, which makes it really interesting. But there is a sense of peace found in the book, although sometimes it's kind of an uneasy peace. One of my favorites is a kind of instructional poem, and it brings us back home here, and it takes us to Limantour Beach at Point Reyes. So I wonder if you'd please read To Get There.
Absolutely, and that is on page...
72.
Thank you. Oop, right there. Oh, wow. Yeah. You know, I haven't read these poems in so long.
Uh-huh.
To myself, that, you know, it's always a surprise when I see them.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. It's wonderful to revisit them, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's fascinating that for me, anyway, this is still my most popular book by fan readers,
mm-hmm.
mostly non poets, and they've when they purchase my other books and read them, I will hear from them. They'll say, they said to me, "Where are you?"
Oh, good.
Because I'm a little more philosophical later, you know, but.
Mm-hmm.
So
we'll talk about that, too.
Sure, absolutely. Okay, To Get There. The name of the next town is Woodacre, and the next San Geronimo, then Lagunitas, then Olima. Make a left onto Limantour Road to the beaches. Slow down as you approach the curve, the small creek funneled under the roadbed. Stop and pick raspberries. Take care you don't get ripped by the razor-sharp thorns. Don't try to save any berries. Eat them right there. Notice the dark under the trees, the madrone and bay, the pine and valley oak. Take the next left and go about a quarter of a mile to the first pullout along the grassy field with birds. Look back over the hills you've traveled, and if there's a need, take a pee in the open. Listen to the chirp and whir of locust. Feel the sun hot on your back, the wind whipping your hair. Continue on for about 8 miles. Watch for elk herds, wild turkey. When you get to the parking lot, You'll notice how the interior of your car seems repressive. It's the ocean, the pour of seawater through the slough of the tide pools. Push the door against the stiff winds and walk the next 1,000 feet to the tawny sand. Take note of the terns, the ravens sitting in the dead cypress, the insistent flies on the stranded seagrass. You have the whole day to yourself. There is no next town, nowhere to go.
Beautiful. So you mentioned just a minute ago that your next two books are more philosophical, and that is something that I noticed, that there's a real shift between your first book and your second book. Yet, I found that by the end of Vents, you have the last two poems really help transit from your first book to your second book. There's a touch of what's to come already. And I tried to choose one of the two poems for you to read, and I just couldn't. So would you please read Remembrance and Fog?
Oh.
And those will bring us to your next book.
Oh, thank you. I love Remembrance. I love its cadence.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in writing, one never knows how one gets where one gets. You know? And this was one of those poems that after I really went, wow.
Yeah, I like this poem. Isn't that wonderful?
Somehow,
yeah.
Remembrance. I have listened. The sound of water is never the same. I have tried to learn the sound by heart. I have tried to learn by heart a river sound, a sea, a drenching rain that drowns the dog day of summer, a soft drizzle. Anything to do with water never sounds the same. I have tried to learn by heart the name of water. The name of water is never the same. The spelling of water is ever changing. The way the mouth forms the word holds the change. Two hands cupped under a faucet. Two hands held high above the leaping waves. One tear clinging. One swept away. The sound of water is never the same, and that is how I remember. The name is never the same, and that is how I lock it away. Unlock the sound.
Before you go on to Fog, I want to let our listeners know that you're listening to Joe read his poem Remembrance, and you can hear the cadence in it, as he mentioned. But what's important to know is when you look at the poem on the page, the poem itself is structured in a way that when you read it yourselves, you hear the cadence right on. It's just beautifully written. So thank you, Joe.
Yeah, thank you for that. Uh-huh. So here we go, into the fog, right?
Yeah.
Fog. Yeah, this is the last poem in the book. I thought that was a good way to end it.
Yeah.
Fog. A voice from behind asked, "What are you thinking?" And I start to turn. Realize the voice was mine, speaking aloud on this cliff at Land's End. The Pacific blue and flaring, from up here making hushing sounds. A penny for your thoughts, I say, talking to myself again. Really, I wasn't thinking at all. I'd reached that place where body disappears and the mind's freed, just being, carried away, lifted from the conscious. A turn makes a pass across my view into a band of sunlight, and for a while nothing exists except the light and the polish of fog touching everything.
Thank you so much. So we are going to move on to your second book now, which is called Render. And the four sections of this book have very different names than your first. They are Lessons, and that's L-E-S-S-E-N-S, Parables, Lessons Again, and Learning. So what jumped up at me is that Lessons is a pun. It should be O-N-S here if you're looking at the lessons and parables and learning together, right? But it's Lessons, E-N-S, Parables, Lessons, E-N-S, and Learning. Yeah. Tell me about the
Well, first word. I should say some people thought that was a mistake.
Oh, no.
And I said, oh, I guess I was being too clever.
No, I knew it wasn't a mistake.
I just wanted it to be, yeah, after each section, it lessened again. It was more lessening.
Yeah.
So that was on purpose, and I'm glad you caught that.
I did.
And asked me about it.
So talk to me just for a minute about the book as a whole, how you made the decisions you did to group the poems into these sections, because I'm always interested in the process. Just a minute of that.
Yeah, I think the first poem, which is called There Is a River, was actually what I thought I was going to title it that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a pretty good title. But then, yeah, the book kept expanding on me and going other places, you know. And, I'm not sure how I put it together, really, but as I was writing and I started grouping the poems, you've probably done this, and probably many poets have done this, you know, take all your poems and go down your long hallway
and
place them.
Yeah.
And that didn't work because it kept sticking to my feet as I was. So finally, I literally did give each section a title before I had the poems together. And then I would just take the poems and put them where I thought each title fit, you know.
To me, that's one of the hardest things is deciding which way they're going to go, how they talk to each other as the book moves along.
So I wanted to start with a kind of a love poem and finish up with, let me see. Well, with an afterword. I thought that was enough. I hope I'm not being too clever.
No,
the last poem is called Afterword.
And it's a great way to end the book. I think we should go there when we're there.
Yeah.
So there are more reflections of Vietnam in this book, Render, but there is an increased intensity, to me at least. The pain is there, but there is a kind of a deeper seeing into things, a deeper looking into things. It's almost Zen-like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the opening poem is indicative of this. So maybe we could start there and read that poem, There Is a River.
There is a river. There is a river near Hue called Perfume. Its water is red, amber during the monsoons. There is a factory that processes rubber, trees with thick green leaves, barks bleeding white. Birds come from around the world to drink from the river. I used to watch them hop, dip their heads, then leap up into air, folding their legs back like a jet's wheels, like corsairs. And there is someone named Du Tan Mai who once took me into her house, fed me rice with her fingers, while I tilted my head back and chewed. She showed me her white jade Buddhas and said I should listen to the stars out in her small garden because they could sing. There was a cot to lie upon, around us bamboo and boxes of lilies, some burnt orange, some white, some darker, and one that was green with white pistils. There was fragrance and river sound. I know we both cried, and if either of us slept, it was pretend.
That is just stunning. A beautiful poem.
Thank you.
Why did that water, why was it red?
Yeah, the thing about Vietnam, which is, when I first got there, I thought all the ground was covered in Agent Orange because it was very red and orangey.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what the soil is like. It's high in iron.
Okay.
Yeah, and so when the rains come every year, a lot of silt comes in, and that makes the rivers look this really incredible red, reddish orange. It's really, really beautiful, actually. It looks muddy, but it's got that color.
Mm-hmm.
The rust really comes out.
So. What a beautiful name for a river to perfume.
Yes, which is, by the way, where the Michelin tire company is, the French company.
Oh.
It was there all the way through the war and in operation.
Amazing. And it's not destroying the place?
Well, probably.
Probably.
These are rubber trees.
Oh, yeah.
So it was plantations.
Okay, we won't go there today.
Okay.
You have another search poem in this book. Mm. It's on page 25.
Yes. I go out to the beach a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Search. Because of its complaint, I come to the sea. Because it is placid on the outtake, I come to understand what can't be understood. The gravity, the pull of forces. What can be felt carries both regret and remorse. A yoke digging into the blades of the body, the whole body. Aimless, pulling a long weight, I spread a blanket on sand, anchor the corners with driftwood, with the shell of a sea turtle, set out bread, pure water. Before this altar, I wait to be lifted.
It just struck me that this poem could have the same title as the poem you read in your first book, Search and Rescue, the whole different kind of searching and a whole different kind of rescue.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, I think I sent this to Poetic Metrics likes Buddhist or Zen-like.
Oh, uh-huh.
And this is one of the poems I sent to the associate editor.
Oh.
And they didn't pick my book, but he said, don't go away. You know, keep reminding me. He said, John Peterson is the publisher. And he said, you know, we can only publish one book a year. But, just keep in touch with me. And so I did.
And sure enough, they published
this
book.
And sure enough, they published it, yeah.
Wow, it pays to listen and follow up, I guess.
That's right.
You have a poem called Something's Wrong.
Mm.
And it begins with two questions. It's a very sad poem that makes me kind of think of Shakespeare, to thine own self be true, you know, that quote. The questions at the beginning could be asked again at the end. That's how powerful they are. Would you please read Something's Wrong?
Something's wrong. What was it I used to feel? What was it? In the pup tent where we slept, the clear, wet smell of the lake, the Newport cigarettes we smoked, the way menthol tasted blue on the back of the tongue. How you wouldn't let me blow out the candle because you wanted to see what my eyes looked like closed. You said you'd always be my best friend, even when we grew up, married. Said I should talk to no one, tell no one. I was holding you. You were holding me. The lake freezing over with pollen while I fell asleep. The dark between the flesh. The lake freezing over the pollen when I fell asleep. The dark between the flash of birch trees I flutter. They say when you OD'd, you had the shakes, tracks on your arms and legs. Your last words, something's wrong. A batch of bad horse, you riding off into the woods. I'll never forget, not any part, even the part I could not see. The part I could not feel. I did not look to see if your eyes were open. I never told anyone.
Mm. Tell me about this person, if you can.
My childhood crush.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can say his name. He passed away.
His
name was Mikey.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived on the opposite side of my street on Coolidge Avenue.
In New Jersey.
In New Jersey.
Yeah.
And he was Polish-American. I was Italian-American.
Mm-hmm.
So. But yeah, it was my first love, I suppose.
Yeah,
and it's really tragic. It really is tragic what happened. But back in the '60s, late '60s, I guess, drugs just really ravaged neighborhoods all across the country.
There's at least a hint in the poem that this may have been someone who couldn't accept who he was.
You know, he was always sure of himself,
mm-hmm.
but I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
I wondered if that's why the drugs and...
Yeah, you know. I think that's right. You know, I'm really glad you brought that up. I hadn't really thought of that myself. You know,
mm-hmm.
I just accepted what happened. I mean, he died very young. He wasn't even 21.
Oh, tragic. So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a very powerful poem. And, you know, again, those questions.
Yeah.
Really something. Well, we are... moving along to your third book now because of time. But first, let me say, this is Word Temple on KRCB. I'm Catherine Hastings, and you are listening to the wonderful Joseph Zicardi sharing his poetry today. So you have a third book, which I have not even seen yet, I'm so sorry to say. It's called The Nine Gradations of Light. It came out a couple of years ago, right?
That's right.
So I'm just going to ask you to choose... you know, two or three poems that you think are, you know, good representations of this book. That's a horrible thing to ask of you, but we'd like to hear some work from this latest book.
Actually, I will read the title a poem, The Nine Gradations of Light, which is the first poem in the book. I should say the book is divided into three sections, brightness, grayness, and darkness.
Uh-huh.
And The Nine Gradations of Light deal with that. It's also divided into three sections. And as I was putting this book together, I realized that things were that went into the brightness section were kind of blinding you.
Mm.
And the things that went into darkness sections allowed you to actually see things.
Oh, interesting.
And the grayness was like, actually, it's more like understanding in the gray one.
Very interesting. Yeah, nice concept.
Thank you. I may mention when I read at Word Temple years and years ago, did you say 2008?
Yes.
I actually read this poem.
Oh, my gosh.
And someone came up to me and said, I want to buy that book. I said, well, it's not a book yet. I said, but I'll let you.
So if you're listening out
there. So here you are. You're listening, whoever you are. The Nine Gradations of Light. Firstly, brightness, which is given as 10 to the power of 10, and is given to mean miracles and snow blindness. It tears at the eyes. It carries water into the thinness between air and vacuum, and is the closest thing to God, and is of itself in three parts. Secondly, grayness, which is given as 10 to the power of 1000, and is given to mean the knowledge of a millennium and short-sightedness. It rends the brain. It clocks everything in its sameness. It is as pliant as mercury, as malleable as iron, and is always halfway between greatness and smallness, and is of itself in three parts. Thirdly, darkness, which is given as 10 to the power of 10,000, and is given to mean eternity and the end of time. It is without vision, without thought. It is without voice, without sound, and is the closest thing to nothingness, and the sum of its three parts equals itself. They are the absence and the presence. They are the void and the amplitude.
Nice. I can see why someone wanted that poem.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's see. This poem has a lot, or quite a few poems that are influenced by Chinese poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll read one of those. I think it's one of my favorites. It's called Li Po and the Student. Li Po and the Student. He unfurls a scroll of rice paper, snatches up a brush, dips it into fresh ink, scrawls 7 characters. His student throws a handful of sand over the wet surface of the poem, blows off the loose grains, reads aloud, then looks up and around at the way the red delta stretches flat, how a lone boatman stands in the stern swaying an oar twice his height, how 3 herons touch their wings to water and dragonflies hover in the rushes, how a stick walker practices among the brown humpbacks of water bison, and beyond, a circle of huts in the haze of wood smoke. Now, Li Po says to his student, take this poem, throw it into a stream, and watch it sail away.
Nice.
Recipe. Parts of the skillet. The hanging ring. The handle and tang. The iron side and bottom. The seasoned surface. The weight. She's showing me how to make goumki. She says the word slowly, goumki, so I'll understand. How to scald the cabbage, how much rice to cook up, the pinches of salt and the measure of time. What cuts of pork and beef are best? What attachment to use on the meat grinder that has the raised foundry's name under the lip of the hopper? What's goumki mean, I ask. I mean, literally. Parts of the knife, the rivets on the handle, the bolster, guard, and heel, the back of the blade, the free edge, the point. Goumki means goumki, she says. She sniffs. Some people call it pigs in a blanket, but that was after the Nazis and Stalin. Now, here's how to make the sauce, my secret. Sour cream, Hungarian paprika, and the fat from the pan juices and flour. Without this, they lie like unclothed bodies, side by side.
Oh my goodness, that's very interesting. Goumki.
Yeah, goumki.
What a great word.
Yeah.
And the pigs in a blanket, that was after the Nazis, you said. Tell me.
Yeah, when after the World War II, when a lot of people came here from Eastern Europe, or you know, who had fortunately got out, they brought that with them, you know. And it has its other, it's Polish, it's also Hungarian, it's all over that area where the Russians, put up the Iron Curtain.
Interesting. So it became pigs in a blanket from that bit of history.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm looking at the clock here, and I'm going to have to move away from your poetry to your Poet Laureate project. So first of all, I want to congratulate you belatedly on having been Marin County Poet Laureate, and now you will forever be the emeritus. I'm sure you're really busy right now because of this project.
Right.
The project was called Changing Harm to Harmony, Bullies and Bystanders Project, and out of it came an anthology by the same name, a book of poems, letters, and other writings. Why don't you tell us how this project came to be?
Well, let's see, about 3 years ago when I didn't entertain to be a poet laureate, but friends came to me and said, you know, would you do it? And I said, no. And they took me to a lunch again and they said, would you let us nominate? And I said, no. And finally I said, yes. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to get picked anyway.
Right, so, right. That's never going to happen.
I'll just go through the process. And so, you know, as I threw my hat in the ring, so to speak, then they said, well, we need to know what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought about that, but I thought, oh, this is a wonderful opportunity to talk about bullying, because I was bullied as a child.
I was wondering if there was one incident okay.
And so that that's what I started with, and I put everything together and what I was planning on doing, which was to do a couple of panel discussions to produce a book that would include not only people from Marin, although I'm Marin County Poet Laureate, I wanted to include more people outside of Marin and across the United States. So when I put a call out for the book, I ran an ad in Poets and Writers, who I have to acknowledge their generosity.
Mm.
You know, they said, oh, yeah, the ad is $150. And I explained what I was doing. And they said, oh, if it's for a benefit, it's free.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah,
it
was still limited to 50 words. But it was really nice of them. I mean, I was happy to pay the money, but it was nice that I could use those monies for other things.
Mm-hmm.
So originally I was going to call the project No More, K-N-O-W with the N-O highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
But as I started talking with my friend Richard Brown, he was talking about the harm bullying caused, and that's what we were really dealing with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was leaving his house one day, I said, harm, the word harm and the word harmony are so close, but I know they're so different.
Right.
And then I thought, wow, I wonder if I could change harm to harmony. And that's where the title came
up. Boom.
Yeah. And I was like, really excited. It's one of those things you're on the road. I've got to remember this. Don't forget.
Right, right. So. Good. So how did you define bullying for the purpose of this project? Because, victimizing often comes out of bullies who have been victimized themselves, right?
Right.
So how did you define bullying?
Well, it was really difficult because really you could, you know, it could be spousal abuse and child abuse and so many things, you know. And of course, it could go, you know, as far as Nazism or you know, or Mussolini, those sort of things, or even, you know, even the Tea Party in the United States where they sort of try to bully people into doing things or bully their representatives.
We have no lack of examples of bullying in this
world. I did try to narrow it. And my first idea was that it should be, what I would focus on, the things that weren't exactly illegal, that weren't already a crime and punishable. But I soon realized that I had to expand it.
Mm-hmm.
So, the gates were broken. You know, I wanted some things about race. Mm-hmm. I wanted some things about the gay people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted some things about certainly the schoolyard, which is a big thing.
And I think you even have at least one poem in the anthology that comes from the perspective of a bully,
yes.
someone who had done bullying,
right.
which, you know, if you're looking back at yourself in time, it must feel pretty bad, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's important that
it's
that's
very
in
true.
Here.
It's very true. That's there. And yeah. I always thought about the bystander. Why the bystander?
Yeah.
You know, because I was a bystander too. Even though
sure.
I was bullied.
We
somebody,
all have been at some point,
oh, yeah.
I bet.
And if I'd done something, and I do mention in the book, in my introduction, I was 13 and there was Richard Dancer was in our school. I was at St. Mary's Grammar School. And he was very obese.
Mm-hmm.
And every morning, you know, he would be in the schoolyard and kids would run up to him and punch him in the belly.
Oh.
You know, and one day I just couldn't take it. You know, and so I don't know where this courage came from, but I decided not to be a bystander somehow. Well, I probably didn't know that word at the time.
Right.
Anyway, I ran up and I stood in front of him. I put my arms outstretched at my side and I said, "Hit me, not him."
Wow.
And the sort of lead bully said, leave him alone and walked away. You know, and I don't really recommend that as a thing to do, but I realized, wow, a bystander can do something.
Absolutely.
You can let someone know. You know, and not just let it happen. And maybe you do have to say a word. You know, I mean, I don't want people to put themselves in a position where they're going to get hurt. But
sometimes there is something you can do.
Yeah.
You know, without.
Yeah. And so my appeal actually to younger, I'm trying to get this to younger people. Mm-hmm. I want the popular kids in school to defend the bullied kid.
Yeah.
They could step forward because they're not going to get hit. You know, if they're in the football team or the basketball team or the, you know, the popular kids, girls and boys.
Well, a former Marin County Poet Laureate, Lynn Follett, C.B. Follett, has a poem in here that I'm not going to read because she is going to be reading the poem along with some other people at Word Temple from this anthology. But she has something, a statement that she wrote right after the poem. And I would like to read that because I think it gives a nice example of what this is about.
Please do.
Her poem is called Such a Pretty Face. And she says, "Such a Pretty Face was written from some experiences I've had as an adult and some experiences I can imagine an overweight child feeling. As a really skinny kid and quite skinny through college, my mother was constantly urging me to eat. I was also very athletic. Won the Women's Athlete Cup my senior year, etc. Was on all my high school and college teams. It was really when all that activity stopped, except for weekly tennis, say, that things got out of hand, that is, my weight gain. I actually wrote this poem for the Bullies and Bystanders panel discussion at Falkirk Cultural Center in San Rafael, California, back on November 2013. As one of the panelists, I got to thinking about the bullying that our parents, families, etc. inflict on their kids, even on kids who don't seem to have issues inviting bullying. It so often starts with the parents. I think they overwant their kids to be perfect or want to find fault because they are worried or need to be in control or need to pick on others because of how they feel about themselves, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. We need to be more aware as humans, but especially as parents, of the lasting impacts of our words and actions, negative and also positive. Compassion, that's a great word to keep in mind." That final sentence of what she wrote, it should be just be echoed all through the book, right?
That's wonderful. I love your reading of that, too.
Oh.
Just wonderful.
So, yeah, I really love what she wrote there. So some titles in the book include Fat Kid, The Girl Who Hanged Herself, Blood Cancer Number One. Mm-hmm. Interesting how you can see a disease as being a bully, too, and Perfect Target. So what were some of the experiences that you had after you put out a call for poems for this project? Were there any surprises for you?
Oh, many, many surprises. Well, one thing was the volume that I received of submissions, at least 5,000 pieces.
Oh, my goodness.
And I sort of stopped counting. And initially, I had three boxes on the floor next to my desk, you know, with definitely yes, maybe, and definitely no. And at the end of the submission period, the no box had almost nothing in it.
Oh,
it was
my.
Really difficult because I really had to turn down many, 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 many poems and letters and expressions of remorse and regret. But I knew, I just felt that a book, I mean, I could have made this book 300 pages long. It's about 150. But I just felt like if I make it too big, people aren't going to read it.
That's right.
It's just too big, you know.
Yeah.
So I really skinnied it down. Some pieces I took were not technically as good as others. I really had to turn down good people. It was really hard for me, but I had to. And I just felt like, well, I need this one's a little more individuality.
Well, you ended up with a really wonderful range of types of work, both poems and letters that people wrote. Different experiences are reflected all throughout the book. So I think anybody out there who has been bullied for almost anything is going to find a poem in this book that speaks to them.
Yeah.
You know, so I think you did a really nice
I've
job.
I've heard from people, of course, about many things, but one was from a mother who said, I'm reading this book to my children, my two girls, and they're, I guess they're 12 and 13, and she's a poet herself, and her children usually don't like her poetry, and they, when she's reading this, they go, Mommy, keep reading it. We really like it. You know, they really got in touch with the things, and there are some rough parts in here that you wouldn't read to a child, but some from rough language.
But they've probably heard
well, yeah,
before we did.
Originally I was thinking, wow, maybe I really shouldn't do that. There are really some rough words in here. But then I thought, well, I don't want to censor, really. And it is really part of life. And as much as it's, I don't like it, I don't use it myself, I try not to use language like that. It's part of who we are as a society.
Right.
And to deny it to pretend it's not there. It's almost pretending like bullying is not there.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a key part of it. So I'm glad you didn't do that.
Yeah, thank you.
So is this book being distributed to schools?
Yes. I let all the contributors in the book, I think there are about 80 contributors, know, and this is all across the country from Hawaii to Massachusetts to Alabama, Texas, that if they want to host or co-host or, a reading or a meeting or a panel discussion, I'll be happy to send them books.
Wonderful.
And so I've heard from Cindy Milwee of Los Angeles. She teaches at a high school, and she's got permission from her principal and, I guess, the people who make decisions to let the book be used in the classroom.
Good.
So I've already sent her books. And there's another poet in Danbury, Connecticut. I can't remember her name right now. She's also going to do the same thing. And I understand... Well, there are lots of things going on. I don't want to...
No, that's really good. Yeah. I'm glad to hear it. How about California Poets in the Schools?
Yes.
Do they have this book?
They have this book. Ben Cleveland of Mount Tam High School, he wants to make a one-act play using having his students act out the poems and letters and pieces in this book. And so that is really going to be something. And he's part of Poets in the School.
Good.
Poets in the School.
Well, would you like to read a poem from the book, just to give us an example?
Sure. I'd like to read one that's from a bystander point of view, and it's by the poet Gary Young, who's from Santa Cruz.
Oh, Gary Young. He writes a lot of prose poetry. Very good poet.
Yeah. I just like his work, and what a gracious man, too. He sent me these poems. Oh, he responded. I didn't actually contact him. He responded to the Poets and Writers ad.
Excellent.
It was really wonderful, And he said, I don't know if you can use these, but I want the perspective of the bystander.
Okay.
And what a bystander can do. So this poem sort of shows that. His poems are all untitled. They bust us to the induction center. Inside, I spilled 100 cups of urine and passed out cigars. When they asked, I was deaf, blind. I was 19, and I didn't know what else to do. They gave me an intelligence test, and I answered every question wrong. An officer said, we'll give you another test. And each time they did, my intelligence failed. I was alone in a room with two men. They stood beside me with their guns drawn and gave me one test after another for hours. One of them said, you son of a bitch, the men you came with are waiting for you outside. and we'll keep them there all night if we have to. He didn't understand. I'd have kept them there forever if I could.
Oh, wow. Read one more.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd like to read one of my favorites. Talk about surprises. This one I'll just read without saying anything first, because if I can find it. This one, the author's legal guardians didn't want me to use his full name.
Oh.
So the it's a letter, but it really sounds like a poem, and it's by Michael C., and it's addressed to me. Dear Mr. Joseph, I wrote this letter. My name is Mike. My first 16 years I spent in a home for me. I have autism. My brother Chris, who I never remember, got me out. I miss my teacher, Mrs. Reese, who was very kind and beautiful, but it is better now. Chris could not find me. He's 24 years old and is married to Susan, my new sister. They have no children. She is kind and wants a baby. Wish I hope for her. She typed this letter, but I wrote this letter because when I was sent to a regular school, not everyone was nice to me. They said I eat funny and talk funny. I was sad, but Mr. Principal talked to all of us and said, this is bad for me and them too. This book my brother told me about, I wish to be in because it is a good thing. Thank you, Mr. Poet, for reading this. I hope you are happy like me too. I wrote this letter, and Chris says it is good. Mike.
Ugh.
I know. I got this. This thing came in, and I went, "Oh my God!"
Wow. Yeah. You know, yeah.
And
so powerful. So
yeah,
powerful.
It's really hard to read. I
yeah. And thank you. Thank you for this project, Joe. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
So, I mean, this show will air after these people come to read from the book at Word Temple, but I'm going to record that reading and we'll have it on air.
Oh, wonderful.
Also.
Terrific.
Okay? So we are just about out of time here. Once again, you've been listening to Joseph Zicardi. He is Marin County Poet Laureate Emeritus. He served for the years 2013 and 2014, and here we are in the new year. So I know your whole next year is going to be very busy. So I'm still going to consider you Poet Laureate.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you for coming. And I want to remind our reader, my listeners, that his books are Vence, Render, and The Nine Gradations of Light. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you, Catherine.
This is Catherine Hastings, and if you would like to hear some poetry read live from this wonderful anthology, the Changing Harm to Harmony, Bullies and Bystanders Project, please come to the Word Temple Poetry Series at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts on Saturday, January 24th at 7 p.m. The address is 282 High Street in Sebastopol. There will be a good number of poets reading their work from the anthology that night. Some of them include Andre Lamont Wilson, Gerald Fleming, C.B. Follett, Jody Hoddle, David Beckman, Ed Coletti, Stephanie Mandel, Rebecca Faust, Susan Terrace, Mark Meyerding, Julia Vose, Ava M. Schlesinger, Barbara Welch Brooks, Alan Cohen, Linda Enders, and Calvin Algren, as well as myself. You probably recognized a fair number of names here because there are a good number of poets from Sonoma County represented in this book. So Joe will be introducing the book that evening, and there are some other poets who will be reading as well, not from the anthology, but from their own books. Local poet Phyllis Meshalom is celebrating her new chapbook from Finishing Line Press, Doll Moon, and the wonderful Ellery Akers is coming to read. She's celebrating her latest collection, Practicing the Truth, which is the winner of the 2014 Autumn House Poetry Prize, and she must be very proud of this because it was judged, the contest was judged by none other than the wonderful Alicia Ostricker. Akers' other collection, Knocking on the Earth, was named Best Book of the Year by the San Jose Mercury News, and was the winner of 11, she's the winner of national 11 National Writing Awards. So again, that is Saturday, January 24th at 7 p.m., the Word Temple Poetry Series at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. Ellery Akers, Phyllis Meshulam, and Joseph Zaccardi with the anthology Changing Harm to Harmony, Bullies and Bystanders Project. All right. This month, January 2015, marks the 60th anniversary of the night Allen Ginsberg read his famous poem Howl in the Six Gallery in San Francisco. So I'm not going to go out with Ginsberg reading that poem tonight, but I am going to play the recording of Lawrence Ferlinghetti performing his beautiful poem, Allen Ginsberg is Dying. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any questions or comments, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.
Allen Ginsberg dying. Allen Ginsberg is dying. It's in all the papers. It's on the evening news. A great poet is dying, but his voice won't die. His voice is on the land, in lower Manhattan, in his own bed. He is dying. There's nothing to do about it. He is dying the death that everyone dies. He is dying the death of the poet. He has a telephone in his hand, and he calls everyone from his bed in lower Manhattan. All around the world, late at night, the telephone is ringing. This is Allen, the voice says. Allen Ginsberg calling. How many times have they heard it? Over the long, great years. He doesn't have to say Ginsberg. All around the world, in the world of poets, there is only one Allen. I wanted to tell you, he says. He tells them what's happening, what's coming down on him. Death, the dark lover, going down on him. His voice goes by satellite over the land, over the sea of Japan, where he once stood naked, trident in hand, like a young Neptune, a young man with black beard, standing on a stone beach. It is high tide, and the seabirds cry. The waves break over him now, and the seabirds cry on the San Francisco waterfront. There is a high wind. There are great white caps lashing the Embarcadero. Allen is on the telephone. His voice is on the waves. I am reading Greek poetry. The sea is in it. Horses weep in it. The horses of Achilles weep in it. Here by the sea in San Francisco, where the waves weep. They make a sibilant sound, a sibylline sound. Allen, they whisper. Allen.